I'm very happy to welcome to our program Marge Baker. She's Executive Vice President with the group People for the American Way. Thanks so much for making time to come on our program, Marge.
Thanks for having me.
Say a quick word, if you would, about People for the American Way for listeners who may not know much about what the group does.
Absolutely. People for the American Way has been around for more than 30 years. We were founded to be a force for confronting the far right that back when we were founded was called the Moral Majority. And since then, we have really fought to protect core constitutional and civil liberties against attacks from the far right, and which is how, in fact, the organization for a very, very long time has had an agenda about making sure that we protect the fairness and balance of the Supreme Court and other federal courts.
Well, thanks, Marge. And we're going to be talking about the Supreme Court and its future and what's at stake in this election on November 8th. But I'll just repeat what I said at the outset of our program as we were talking about Social Security. There's so many important issues that should be the focus of debate and discussion and analysis in our corporate media. But unfortunately, this campaign has been obscene and grotesque and focused on just insane subject matter and just disquieting altogether. But of course, among those many substantive issues that have received less than their deserved share of attention in this election campaign is the future of the U.S. Supreme Court, which with the Republicans in the Senate blocking President Obama's nominee to the High Court, Merrick Garland, the court has been in a 4-4 tie for many recent rulings since the death of Antonin Scalia some months ago. And Marge, I wanted to ask you at the outset here of this discussion about the Supreme Court, what's at stake from the point of view and your organization with the court, both the issues that will be ruled on in the near future, as well as the opportunities that the next president will have to replace some elderly and expectant retiring Supreme
Right.
Court justices.
Right. Well, just about, and I really appreciate the opportunity to talk about this, just about every issue the American public cares about deeply is affected by the Supreme Court. So if you care about being able to have reasonable regulations of reasonable rules around campaign finance, if you care about the environment, if you care about voting rights, if you care about women's rights, if you care about choice, if you care about LGBT equality, if you care about workers' rights to organize, if you care about immigrants' rights, every single one of those is affected by who sits on the court and the balance on the Supreme Court. And you're absolutely right. What we have now is a court that essentially is tied 4-4 and is paralyzed in many cases from making decisions. For example, in the recent case involving the president's executive actions on immigration. But more importantly, we have an opportunity in this election to elect someone who in Hillary Clinton, who understands that you need justices on the court, who respect the Constitution as a document that's there for all Americans, not just for the wealthy and the privileged, and who understands the importance of having people on the bench who have the real life experiences to understand the impact of their decisions on average Americans and who support core constitutional values of liberty, equality, justice. So there's a huge, huge amount at stake in this election around who sits on the court, not just in terms of whether we continue to have the vacancy that Merrick Garland's been nominated to remain empty, which remains to be seen, but because there are at least three more justices who, during the course of the next presidency, will be more than 80 years old, and the average retirement age for justices is less than that. So the future of the court for generation is at stake in this election, which is why it's so critical, and we've been working so hard.
Marge, can you describe for our listeners the relative positions of both Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump as relates to the Supreme Court and what their plan would be?
Well, as I said, Secretary Clinton has articulated a standard for the kinds of justices that she would look for, and she said that she wants justices to respect the Constitution that's there for all Americans, not just the powerful and the privileged, and she's been clear about issues such as choice and campaign finance rules, reasonable campaign finance rules, and LGBT equality, and any number, workers' rights, any number of issues. Donald Trump, on the other hand, has basically said he's going to outsource the selection of his nominees to a very, very conservative Federalist Society and the Heritage Foundation, and he's given us a list of justices that he would nominate to the bench if he were elected. That is truly frightening. One of the justices on his list believes that Social Security, Medicare, minimum wage, child labor laws, disaster relief, food safety laws, and the Violence Against Women Act are all unconstitutional. And another called the Roe v. Wade decision the worst abomination of constitutional law in our history. So the choices could not be more stark between these two candidates. And what we've been trying to emphasize as we talk to potential, as we talk to voters is, you know, there's a binary choice here. It's going to be either Secretary Clinton or Donald Trump who are going to be president, and they will have the ability to choose to replace three, potentially four justices on the Supreme Court. And so it matters. It absolutely matters in a presidential election who you vote for. And frankly, it also matters, and we can go into it a little bit, in terms of the Senate, because we've seen what a GOP-controlled Senate will do in terms of ignoring its constitutional responsibility to give the nominee fair consideration. So if the Senate remains in Republican hands and Secretary Clinton is elected president, she's still going to have trouble getting her nominees through. So we absolutely, in our view, have to have a Democratic-controlled Senate in order to make sure that the nominees that Secretary Clinton puts forward, if she's elected president, will actually have be given fair consideration.
Marge, as we talked about just a little while ago, President Obama nominated Merrick Garland to be his choice for the vacancy left by the death of Antonin Scalia on the court. Republicans in the Senate have blocked that, stating, in contradiction to what's laid out in the U.S. Constitution, that the next president should have the choice of their Supreme Court justice. But there's a lot of speculation that if Hillary Clinton wins the November 8th election, that the lame duck Republican-controlled Senate may opt to actually vote on Merrick Garland's nomination before President Obama leaves office, concerned that Hillary Clinton might nominate someone in a potentially majority Democrat Senate that would be more progressive than Merrick Garland nominated by Obama. What are your thoughts on this?
So it is quite possible. And the Senate certainly could take up the Garland nomination and lame duck, and we actually hope that that's what they do. I mean, again, this is President Obama's nominee. President Obama is entitled to have his nominee considered. Merrick Garland is eminently qualified. There's been some rumblings on the Republican side. Senator Flake, for example, from Arizona, who's a member of the Senate Judiciary Committee, has talked about a lame duck confirmation. If that doesn't happen, I think Secretary Clinton is absolutely right in terms of not indicating, you know, what she would do in the event that that the Senate doesn't act during the lame duck session. She has said she hopes that the Senate confirms Mark Garland in the lame duck session, but she's absolutely right to reserve her options, you know, were she to become president, to pick whoever she wants as president to pick. But so we'll see what happens. But I think there is, I mean, there's a number of senators are getting an enormous amount of pressure from their constituents for the way in which they've treated Garland. And you've got now senators saying they won't support Donald Trump, they won't vote for Donald Trump, but they're still holding the nomination, the vacancy open for presumably for Trump to fill, even though they don't want Trump to be elected. So it's absolutely, they've backed themselves into absolutely absurd corners. And some Republicans, Senator McCain, for example, has said that he wouldn't let any nominee that that Secretary Clinton puts forward as president wouldn't give that nominee fair consideration, and he's getting a lot of heat for that. So it's just they're taking absolutely absurd positions on this, and hopefully reason will prevail. We may see action in the lame duck, and if not, we'll see what a President Clinton does.
What's your view of Merrick Garland? Would you like to see a president-elect, if that's what happens on November 8th? Would you like to see her nominate someone with more progressive credentials?
I think if the Republican Senate doesn't confirm Garland during a lame duck session, then I think President Clinton should make a decision about who she thinks is most qualified for that position, and it could be Merrick Garland or it could be someone else, and I would you know suggest she give it as she will long hard thought, but I do think it makes absolute sense for the Senate to take Garland's nomination up during the lame duck session. And again, I think part of this is this notion that somehow President Obama didn't have the constitutional kind of right to nominate somebody to fill the seat because he was in the last year of a 4-year term. He is our elected president. He will be our elected president until mid-January of next year, and he ought to have his nominee considered.
We're speaking with Marge Baker, Executive Vice President with the group People for the American Way, and we're talking about the U.S. Supreme Court and what's at stake in the November 8th presidential election, as well as a congressional election, because, of course, the majority of the party that controls the U.S. Senate is a determining factor in who is going to be approved or not in terms of future U.S. Supreme Court nominees. Marge, I wanted to ask you about the issue of abortion, Roe versus Wade. We've seen, especially since 2010, when there was a wave of Republican victories in state legislatures and governor's seats across the country, a lot of very draconian laws put in place to restrict women's access to abortion and reproductive rights in general. When it comes to this court in the near term, what kinds of decisions will they be facing, and what issues might be determined here that will stand for a generation or more to come?
Right. Well, there's a couple of different issues. One is issues that we've seen, as you suggest, there's been legislatures that have passed measures that are really efforts to eliminate abortion, but they do it through they're called trap laws, targeted. The targeted laws intended to restrict the access to abortion, and unnecessary requirements about medical privileges or hospital-like institutions or settings that really involve giving a woman a pill, which is what the method is, and just this really excessive requirements that are designed not to protect the woman's health, but to prevent the woman from being able to access abortion services and leading to clinics being closed. So we're going to see more and more of situations like that. That really tests the limits of access to abortion. So that's one set of issues that we'll see come up. The other issues that we saw, for example, in case like a Hobby Lobby, is the extent to which there are efforts to use religious liberty not as an effort to shield one's practice of religion, but really as a sword to discriminate against women who want access to reproductive services, or in many cases LGBT individuals that wanted to be treated with fairness and dignity. So we're going to see cases like that move through the courts, and in both cases, it really matters who sits on the court, and it matters that you have justices who understand the Constitution as sort of respecting those core values of equality and liberty and justice, and who also understand the kind of real world enough that they get how the decisions they're making impact average Americans. So those will be some of the kinds of decision areas in the choice arena that we'll see.
one critical issue you mentioned and that we often focus on here on this program, and that is the prospect of a future Supreme Court overturning the Citizens United decision, which opened the floodgates of unlimited and unaccountable money to candidates through corporations and to a lesser extent labor unions. But what are the prospects for a future court over the next few years, for example, that might consider a case that could potentially overturn Citizens United?
Right. I mean, I think as we've discussed before, and we think the decision in Citizens United and other decisions before and after are fundamentally flawed because they really constrain the ability of states and the federal government to set reasonable rules about the raising and spending of money in elections. And so what we have now is the court adhering to a standard that we don't think is soundly based in the Constitution, but that essentially allows regulation only in instances where there is basically quid pro quo corruption, which means bribery. What a future court that's more balanced could do is could take a look at that standard and understand that it's absolutely not just bribery, not quid pro quo corruption. In fact, it's not just corruption, but it's needing rules that permit that help foster a government that's responsible to the people, and so we would hopefully see over the course of time cases brought before the court in which the court kind of rethinks the standard that's appropriate to be used in terms of allowing for reasonable regulation. So you might see tighter contribution limits, you might see greater promotion of small donor public financing programs, clearly more disclosure and more transparency. So lots of ways in which a court using an appropriate constitutionally based standard could allow much more room for states and the federal government to set reasonable rules that help rein in the influence of money in politics.
Marge, one other issue we touched on already, but I want to mention it here, and that is to go in a little bit more depth, and that is we have seen growing income inequality in this country, which has certainly since the rise of Occupy Wall Street and certainly with Bernie Sanders' campaign, we've seen growing income inequality to become a very important issue in U.S. politics. But there have been many studies, of course, that link the rise of income inequality to the decline of labor unions. And we've seen states around the country dominated by Republican governors and legislatures curtail the right of workers to form unions and to bargain collectively. We've seen that in Wisconsin. There was an attempt to do that in Ohio as well, which was turned back by a referendum. But there are other efforts underway across the country in similar realms. Right-to-work states have increased their number around the country. The Supreme Court has entertained cases that would curtail the right of labor unions to collect dues from members and non-members who benefit from the negotiations that take place in the factory floor or in the workplace.
Mm-hmm.
What are the opportunities, do you think, in a Supreme Court with new and more progressive justices to enhance the right of workers to organize as opposed to, really curtail their right, as has been the trend in recent years?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think the court had been poised to really fundamentally undermine the ability of public unions to organize and to function on behalf of workers, and the court had been reviewing a lower court decision that would have and its review could have potentially really undermined the workers' ability to organize, and in fact the court had kind of invited a challenge so that it could do that, and then with Justice Scalia's passing, the court ended up in a 4-4 tie, not able to do what it intended to do. So clearly, a more balanced court could would avoid that and could again reset the standard for what kind of sort of landscape, what kind of ground work for adequate functioning of unions is possible. I think so it could start looking at the standard of review and start sort of resetting the table in terms of recognizing the value that unions provide to all workers it represents, whether in fact they are members or not. So that's going to be one of the key issues. And the other thing that I think we should note is that what a sort of more balanced court could do would also be to affirm the ability of both federal and state agencies to set the rules of the marketplace in a way that benefits workers and working families and average Americans, and as opposed to substituting the court's judgment for what it thinks reasonable regulation should be. And that affects just a whole slew of situations from the environment to efforts to create more equality in the workplace to issues around discrimination in the workplace. Just a whole set of ways in which the governmental agencies can act in the public interest and not have those actions undermined by the court stepping in and kind of redoing the kind of administrative analysis that typically they would give credence to.
Well, Marge, I did have one more topic that we could tackle in the next couple of minutes, and that is, you know, there are many disgruntled progressive activists who basically want to opt out of this election,
mm-hmm.
not happy with the choices of either Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton. And you often hear them say, you know, it doesn't really matter. If I sit out the election or I vote for a third-party candidate, you know, what's the difference? It's all going to be horrible anyway.
Yeah.
You know, kind of just very cynical. And you know, who can blame people for having that attitude? But when you get to the real world, and we've been talking about it tonight, there are some fundamental choices that will be made by the next president as regards to the Supreme Court that will affect people in this country for, you know, 10, 20, 30 years ahead. What's your best argument that you make for people not to sit out this election, even if they are convinced that they are voting for the lesser of two evils?
Yeah, this is a unique moment in history where we have an opportunity to rebalance the court and rebalance it in favor of the American people as opposed to sort of wealthy, powerful special interests. And kind of shame on us if we don't take advantage of that moment. And it is a choice that voters will make that affect not just the next 4 years, but generations. The next 40 years or more. And so there's a stark choice. There's a stark choice to be made here. And if there were a single reason for someone who, and I totally understand people who are, you know, disenchanted with the choices, but if there is a reason to go out and vote, there is a huge choice here, and it's going to be either Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton who's going to be selecting up to three or four justices on the Supreme Court who serve for life and therefore will be there for generations. And it is a critical, critical opportunity, and kind of shame on us if we don't take advantage of that.
Well, thank you, Marge. I think this is a very critical discussion that people should have in a lot of detail about what's at stake with the Supreme Court. So thanks for all your work on this, and I hope this is just the start of the conversation for many of our listeners who may be torn about participation in the election on November 8th. You know, it's just important to think about what really could happen in this country depending on voters' choice. So leave our listeners, if you would, with your website there, People for the American Way.
Sure. Please go to pfaw.org, pfaw.org, and we've got all sorts of resources and materials that we'll talk about a number of the issues that we've just talked about on this call and many, many more, and detailed materials on potential Trump justices that should scare people a lot. So if you go to pfaw.org, lots of materials there, and thank you so much for for having me.
All right. Appreciate it, Marge, and thanks for all your hard work.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. That's Marge Baker, Executive Vice President with the group People for the American Way, PFAW.org, and talking about the Supreme Court and what's at stake in this November's election.